Timaeus, a dialogue of Socrates with Timaeus, Hermocrates, and Critias.
1, 2, 3, and the fourth, dear Timaeus, where has he gone? Yesterday you four were my guests, today you are my hosts.
Some illness came over him, Socrates. He would never have willingly stayed away from this gathering.
Then it falls to you, and these others to fill in his part, as well as your own.
Certainly, and as far as we're able, we won't leave anything out. It wouldn't be right, having been so generously entertained by you yesterday, for those of us who remain not to return the hospitality eagerly.
Well then, do you remember all that I asked you to speak about, and on what topics?
Some of it we remember, and whatever we don't, you're here to remind us. Or rather, if it isn't too much trouble, run through it again briefly from the beginning, so that it will be fixed more firmly in our minds.
I'll do that. Yesterday my speech about the Constitution came, I think, to this main point. What sort of city, and made up of what sort of men, seemed to me likely to prove the best?
Yes, indeed, Socrates, and it suited all of us very well.
Didn't we first, in that city, separate off the class of farmers and all the other craftsmen from the class of those who would fight in its defense?
Yes.
And giving to each, according to nature, the one occupation suited to him alone, one single craft each, those whom it was necessary should fight on behalf of everyone, we said should be only guardians of the city, whether some enemy came from outside or some wrongdoer from within, judging leniently those under their rule who were by nature their friends, but becoming harsh toward the enemies they met in battle.
Quite so.
For we said, I believe, that the guardian souls must have a nature that is at once spirited and, equally, exceptionally philosophically, so that they could rightly be gentle toward the one group and harsh toward the other.
Yes.
And what about their upbringing? Weren't they to be brought up entirely in gymnastics and music, and whatever other studies were fitting for them?
Certainly.
And we said that those raised in this way should never consider gold or silver or any other possession as their own private property, but rather, as auxiliaries receiving pay for their guardianship from those they protect, pay proportionate to what temperate people need. They should spend it in common and live together, sharing their daily life, devoting themselves at all times to the care of virtue, and keeping free from all other occupations.
Yes, that too was said, in just that way.
And indeed, we also spoke about the women, how their natures should be matched to be similar to the men's, and that all occupations should be shared in common between them, both in war and in the rest of life.
That too was said, in just that way.
And what about the matter of childbearing? Or is this, because of how unfamiliar the proposals were, easy to remember, that we made marriages and children common to all, arranging things so that no one would ever privately know which child was his own, and that all would consider all the rest to be their kin, brothers and sisters, those within the proper age range, and those older going further back, parents and the ancestors of parents, and those younger, descendants and the children of descendants.
Yes, and that too is easy to remember, just as you put it.
And in order that, as far as possible, they might be born with the best natures right away, don't we recall that we said the rulers, both men and women, must secretly arrange by a kind of lottery for the joining together in marriage, so that the bad would be paired off separately from the good, each with their like, and so that no hostility would arise among them over this, since they would believe chance was responsible for the pairing.
We remember.
And further, that the children of the good were to be reared, while those of the bad were to be secretly distributed among the rest of the city, and that as they grew, those overseeing them should always watch and bring back up again any who proved worthy, while those among the upper class who proved unworthy should be exchanged into the place of those coming up.
Just so.
Have we, then, already gone through everything as we did yesterday, summing it up again in outline? Or is there something still missing that we long to hear, my dear Timaeus?
Not at all. This was exactly what was said, Socrates.
Then you may now hear what comes next, concerning the constitution we've described, and the sort of feeling I happen to have about it. My feeling toward it is rather like this, as if someone, having seen beautiful animals somewhere, whether rendered in a painting or truly alive but at rest, should fall into a desire to see them in motion, actually doing something athletic that seemed to suit their bodies. That is just what I feel toward the city we've described. I would gladly listen to someone recounting the contests that a city like this engages in, competing against other cities, how fittingly it goes to war, and in fighting renders what is due to the education and upbringing it has given, both in its actual deeds and in its negotiations in speech with each of the other cities. Now, on this score, Crisias and Hermocrates, I have judged myself incapable of ever adequately praising such men and such a city. And it's no wonder in my own case, but I have formed the same opinion about the poets, both those of former times and those living now. Not that I disparage the poetic race, but it is plain to everyone that the imitative kind will most easily and best imitate whatever it has been raised among, while whatever lies outside a person's upbringing is hard to imitate well in deeds, and harder still to imitate well in words. As for the sophists' class, I consider them well versed in many fine speeches and other things, but I fear that, being wanderers from city to city, and never having settled in homes of their own, they may miss the mark when it comes to the sort of things that philosophically and political men would do and say in dealing with each other in the actual business of war and battle, whether in action or in negotiation. There remains, then, only your class, men who by both nature and upbringing partake of both qualities. For here is Timaeus from Locri in Italy, a city with excellent laws, a man second to none there in wealth and lineage, who has held the highest offices and honors in his city, and who has, in my opinion, reached the very summit of philosophy. And Crisias, all of us here know he is no amateur in any of the matters we're discussing. As for Hermocrates' nature and upbringing, we must trust, on the testimony of many, that he is equal to all of this. That is why yesterday, when you asked me to go through the account of the Constitution, I gladly obliged, knowing that none of you, if willing, could give the speech that follows more adequately than you three, for you alone among people today could, having set the city on a proper footing for war, render everything fitting to it. So having given what was asked of me, I in turn imposed upon you what I am now asking for, and you agreed among yourselves, after consulting together, that you would today repay me the hospitality of your speeches. And here I am, ready and prepared for it, most eager of all to receive it.
Indeed, Socrates, as Timaeus here said, we will not fall short in eagerness, nor is there any excuse for us not to do this. So yesterday, as soon as we left here and reached Crisias' guest house where we are staying, and even before that, along the way, we were considering just this. And Crisias here introduced an account to us drawn from ancient hearsay. Tell it now to Socrates too, Crisias, so he can join in judging whether or not it fits what has been asked of us.
We must do that, if it also seems good to our third partner, Timaeus.
It does indeed.
Listen then, Socrates, to an account that is quite strange, yet wholly true, as Solon, the wisest of the seven sages, once said. He was, in fact, a close kinsman and dear friend of Drapides, our great-grandfather, a fact Solon himself mentions at many points in his poetry. And he told our grandfather Crisias, as the old man in turn recounted to us, that this city had performed great and wonderful deeds long ago, which had been forgotten through time and the destruction of those who did them. And one deed above all was the greatest, which it would now be fitting for us to recall, both to repay you for your account, and at the same time, at the festival, to praise the goddess truly and justly, as if singing a hymn in her honor.
Well said. But what was this deed, Crisias, not merely spoken of, but which Krishas related on Solon's testimony as having actually been performed by this city long ago.
I will tell it, an ancient account I heard from a man who was himself not young. For at that time Krishas was, as he said, close to 90 years old already, and I was about 10. It happened to be the Kurotes day of the Apaturia festival for us. The customary event of the festival took place for the children as always. Our fathers set prizes for us in recitation. Many poems by many poets were recited, and since Solon's verses were still new at that time, many of us boys sang them. Then one of our clan members, whether he really thought so at the time or wished to do Krishas a favor, said that he considered Solon not only the wisest of men in other respects, but also in his poetry, the most nobly free of all poets. The old man, I remember it well, was greatly pleased, and said with a smile, "If only, Aminander, he had not treated poetry as a mere pastime, but had taken it seriously, as others do, and had completed the account he brought back here from Egypt, instead of being forced to neglect it because of the civil strife and other troubles he found here upon his return. In my opinion, neither Hesiod nor Homer nor any other poet would ever have become more celebrated than he." "What was this account?" the man asked. "It concerned," he said, "what would most justly be called the greatest and most renowned of all deeds, one which this city actually performed, but which, through time and the destruction of those who did it, has not survived down to us. Tell it from the beginning," the man said, "what it was and how, and from whom Solon heard it as true." "There is a place in Egypt," he said, "in the delta, where the stream of the Nile splits at its head, called the Satic district. The greatest city of this district is Sais, the home, too, of King Amasis, whose city has a goddess as its founder, called in Egyptian Neith, and in Greek, as they themselves say, Athena. They are great lovers of Athens, and claim to be in some way akin to us. Solon said that, when he arrived there, he was held in the highest honor among them, and that once, when he was questioning the priests most versed in such matters about antiquity, he discovered that neither he himself nor any other Greek, so to speak, knew anything at all about these things. And once, wanting to draw them into discussion of ancient times, he tried to tell them the oldest stories we have here, about Phoroneus, said to be the first man, and Niobe, and how, after the flood, Deucalion and Pyrrha survived, weaving in their genealogy, and trying to reckon the years of all he mentioned by counting up the generations. Then one of the priests, a very old man, said, "Solon, Solon, you Greeks are always children. There is no such thing as an old Greek." Hearing this, Solon asked, "What do you mean by that?" "You are all young in your souls," the priest said, "for you have in them no belief grown old through ancient tradition, no learning hoary with time. And the reason is this: humanity has perished many times over in many different fashions and will perish again, the greatest by fire and water, but others, lesser ones, by countless other means. For even the story told among you, that Phaethon, son of Helias, once yoked his father's chariot, and being unable to drive it along his father's course, scorched everything upon the earth before a thunderbolt struck him down and killed him. This is told in the form of a myth, but the truth behind it is a shifting of the bodies that move around the earth in the heavens, and a destruction, occurring at long intervals, of the things on earth by a great fire. At such times, all those who live in the mountains, and in high, dry places perish more than those who dwell near rivers or the sea. But for us, the Nile is our savior in this as in other respects, since it releases us from this very difficulty by its flooding. But whenever the gods cleanse the earth by drowning it under water, those in the mountains, herdsmen and shepherds, survive, while those in your cities are swept down to the sea by the rivers. But here in our country, water never streams down onto the fields from above, not on those occasions nor on any other. On the contrary, everything here naturally rises up from below. This is the reason, and the cause, why what is preserved here is said to be the oldest. The truth is that in all places where excessive cold or heat does not prevent it, there is always a race of human beings, now more, now fewer. and whatever notable or great deeds have occurred, whether among you or here or in any other place we have heard of, all of these have been written down here in our temples from of old and preserved, whereas among you and the others, records have only just been put together each time, using writing and all the other things cities need. And then again, after the usual cycle of years, a flood from heaven comes upon them like a plague, and leaves only the illiterate and uncultured among you, so that you become young again, as it were, from the beginning, ignorant of all that took place in ancient days, whether here or in your own land. Certainly, Solon, the genealogies you just recounted about your own people differ little from children's tales. First, because you remember only one flood of the earth, though there were many before it. And second, because you do not know that the finest and best race of all mankind once lived in your land, from whom you yourself and your whole present city are descended, a small seed having been left over. But this has escaped you, because for many generations the survivors passed away without setting anything down in writing. There was once an age, Solon, prior to the greatest of the destructions by water, when the city that is now Athens was the best in war and in every way surpassingly well governed. It is said to have accomplished the finest deeds and had the finest constitutions of any we have heard report of under heaven. Hearing this, Solon said he was astonished, and was altogether eager to ask the priests to relate to him in full detail, in order, everything about the ancient citizens. The priest said, "I begrudge you nothing, Solon. I will tell it for your sake and your cities, but chiefly to honor the goddess who received both your land and this one as her portion and reared and educated them, yours 1,000 years earlier, when she received the seed of you from earth and Hephaestus, and this one later. The number of years since the establishment of order here is written in our sacred records as 8,000. I will show you briefly the laws of the citizens who lived 9,000 years ago, and the finest of their deeds. The exact details of all of it, in order, we will go through another time at leisure, taking up the actual writings themselves. For now, consider the laws in comparison with those here, for you will find many examples here now of things that existed among you then. First, the class of priests, set apart from the others. Then next, the class of craftsmen, each working at its own trade without mixing with another, the herdsmen, the hunters, and the farmers. And you have surely noticed that the warrior class here is kept separate from all the other classes, forbidden by law to concern themselves with anything except matters of war. Consider, too, the style of their armament, shields and spears, with which we were the first in Asia to arm ourselves, the goddess having shown this to us just as she did to you first in those regions. As for wisdom, you see how much care the law here took from the very beginning, concerning the ordering of the cosmos, discovering all the way down to divination and medicine for the sake of health, deriving human arts from these divine things, and acquiring all the other branches of learning that follow from them. This whole system, an order the goddess established when she founded you first, choosing the place in which you were born, having observed the temperate climate there, that it would produce the wisest men. Being herself a lover of both war and wisdom, the goddess chose the region likely to produce men most like herself, and settled it first. So you lived under such laws, and governed even better, surpassing all mankind in every virtue, as befits those who are the offspring and pupils of gods. Many great deeds of your city are recorded here and admired, but one surpasses all others in greatness and excellence. The records tell how great a power your city once halted as it marched in insolence against the whole of Europe and Asia at once, setting out from beyond, from the Atlantic Ocean.